Welcome everyone to Art of Advisory and welcome to my co-host, Kirk Bowman, where we talk about how to build an advisory practice or how to change the mindset from sort of a compliance, hourly billing type of practice to a solutions-driven, results-driven type of practice. Hey, Kirk, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Hector. What's up?
Hey, I wanted to start with asking you a question because I think, to me, language is fascinating. And sometimes some of these concepts and idioms, they sort of have a backstory and there are things that we use every day. Sometimes we don't know what it is. So I would love to deep dive into a concept that I was explaining to someone that's not from this country. What does leaving money on the table mean? So could you in your own words tell me, what does it mean to leave money on the table, the expression leaving money on the table?
So the expression leaving money on the table, first of all, it comes out of a skill set or a mindset of where we actually price the customer rather than just charging an hourly rate or a standard fee for the same service, but where we actually set a price for each customer based on a conversation we've had with them. So when you're pricing, the goal with pricing is to, number one, maximize the value you create for the customer, because when you maximize the value, you then raise the ceiling for setting a price. In other words, the higher the value you create for the customer, the higher the price you can charge. Customers don't mind paying a higher price if they're receiving more value. The idea of leaving money on the table simply means after you quoted the price and the customers accepted it and you typically have started the work, you kind of have one of those moments where you might call it pricer's regret when you realize that you didn't charge as high a price as you could. You realize that the customer actually would have been willing to pay more than you charged in a price for the particular value. And so we call that leaving money on the table. Now, everybody leaves money on the table. There is no perfect price. And so we're simply always trying to determine, okay, what is the value? What is the customer's perception of that value? And then set the price that is literally just 1 cent below where they would say no.
Now, I was doing some research, Kirk. I don't know if you may know this or not, but I was trying to figure out where it came from because a lot of these idioms come from some, you know, everyday thing. And there's different sources, but it sounds like leaving money on the table comes from poker. And when you actually put, you know, you're betting and bluffing, right, that you have a better hand and you put the money on the table. And then some of the folks call you out on that bluff, and then basically you fold and you left the money on the table. The other kind of on the same area. I don't know if you play poker yourself, but when you actually don't bet high enough for people to call you to then show your cards and then win, and then you're basically leaving money on the table. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I don't know if you knew that, but I think leaving money on the table. I think it also works in both areas, not just the service provider or the seller. I think it also happens to the customer. I mean, don't customers go through this analysis saying, you know, if I pay too much, aren't I leaving money on the table? What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, let me just comment. I'm not surprised that the phrase leaving money on the table comes out of a poker analogy. I just will add that I hate the analogy of poker when it comes to pricing, because poker, there's a winner and a loser. And when we talk about pricing, there's actually two winners. Both the customer and the professional win in a true pricing scenario. So just a little commentary there. And I'm not really saying that directly to you. I mean, there's Reed Holden, who's a very well-known pricer, one of the leading minds on pricing. He uses a poker analogy in one of his books, and pricing with confidence. And I don't even like it there. So it's even used by leading authors. And again, I just don't like it because it kind of promotes this idea of, you know, zero sum game, that whenever there is some type of transaction that somebody wins and somebody loses. So I'll get off my soapbox. So you were asking about the customer leaving money on the table. I don't think customers leave money on the table. At least the way I've always thought of it is, it's the professional, it's the provider who is leaving money on the table because they're the ones setting a price. I mean, I think from a customer's perspective, I think they would love, if they realize it, a lot of times they don't, they'd never know. But I think from a customer's perspective, the customer hopes that a professional might leave money on the table because they get to save money. I mean, customers, consumers, whether they're, you know, B2C, business to consumer, or B2B, business to business, they want to maximize the resources. They want to maximize the amount of value they're able to purchase for their dollar or for their cash. So I don't think of leaving money on the table in terms of the customer. Now, can it be harmful to the customer if the professional leaves money on the table? Certainly. We're going to get into that here in a minute when we start talking about kind of the pros and cons. But it's really just from the pricer. And I would simply add, I'm going to throw this out there. If you're billing by the hour or, you know, doing some type of way of charging the customer that's not truly based on determining the value and setting a price, then I think it's pretty much impossible to leave money on the table, right? I mean, about the only way you can do it hourly billing is you realize, oh gosh, this customer's a pain in the neck. I should have charged a higher rate. Well, not easy to do that, right? But again, to me, billing by the hour is not pricing. It's billing. It's after the fact. Pricing is a skill that happens in advance, requires judgment. And so I really think leaving money on the table is really something that's only unique to people who are truly pricing.
But you know, customers don't always say yes, right? I mean, even if you're the best pricer in the world, even if you somehow can detect ballpark the value the customer is willing to pay, customers don't always say yes. I mean, there's an offer and there's an acceptance, and there's many at times offers that go with that acceptance. There's many people that go to stores and shop around, window shop, and they don't buy. And maybe they don't buy because they bought online because they found it cheaper. Maybe they don't buy because the salesperson didn't encourage the sale good enough. Maybe they were not ready. But there's always a sense that that this is not a good deal. Let's call it that. This is not a good deal. And I think that the previous fear of buying something that you weren't sure if it's what you wanted or if it has the full value is the one that stops people from making those purchases. I think that there are many cases in which you present a service or a package, whatever it happens to be, and it's extremely well presented. It talks to all the points, it solves all the problems, it answers all the questions, and the customer still says no. So, you know, it's not always the case that customers always feel that they're getting their money's worth. And I think it's that fear of leaving money on the table or not getting enough bang for the buck, or what you're selling is not worth what they're paying for, I think is what breaks down a lot of transactions. So you're right. I think leaving money on the table is an expression that we use for service providers that charge too little for a service, right? So they left money on the table, let's call it that. But, you know, I get a lot of pushback from even my colleagues, accounting professionals, that they say, look, I tried to do quote unquote value-based pricing. I was charging these flat fees where it was over what the customer wanted to pay, or in their mind, it was more expensive because it wasn't hourly. I mean, that's another conversation on how that could be all sorts of wrong. But when they give a price to a customer and the customer says no, you know, and the customer walks away because there was no option there, technically there are two cases of leaving money on the table. There's the customer that says, hey, I don't want to pay too much. I don't want to leave money on the table on this deal, so I'm going to say no. And then the service provider, because the customer is saying no, maybe they're feeling that they left money on the table because they couldn't win the deal on a sort of a fixed pay, fixed price sort of scenario. So what do you think? What can you speak to around that anxiety, that anxiety of being told no, or the anxiety of pricing it wrong and not getting the deal? What do you think about that?
So just to comment on our prior discussion about, you know, kind of the customer's view, maybe the customer's side of this topic, I think probably the term that we were searching for is buyer's remorse. right? I think we've all experienced that where the exact situation you described happens, where we have made a purchase, we realize we're not going to get the value that we thought. And so at that point, we feel like we paid too much, right? And so if there is an ancillary term or feeling to this for the customer, I think I would call it buyer's remorse. But your question kind of goes the other way, okay, where the customer actually says no because they feel like the price is too high. So it's not remorse. It's just, in this case, they won't have remorse because they were able to say no based to the price up front. That can happen. One of the biggest, I don't want to call it a technique. I actually think it's serving the customer, but one of the best ways to help provide the customer an opportunity to say yes is to increase the number of yeses that are available to them. How do you do that? Well, you offer them options. Okay, think about it this way. If you offer a customer one price for one service or one package, you're basically giving them an opportunity to say yes or no. It's 50-50. Flip a coin and there's your answer. If you offer them three choices, what I like to call options, and I think there is a lot of wisdom in the number three. Two is one too few, four is one too many. We get into that at some other time. But basically offering them three, you're offering them three yeses. And so now the customer, you have increased the likelihood of a yes by 25%. It's no longer 50-50, it's 75-25. There's only a 25% chance the customer will say no. And there is a 75% chance because there's three different options and they can say yes to any of those three. So by offering options, you have increased the likelihood of a yes. You've also given the customer a chance to self-select between the options. So if they're desiring, say, the middle option, but there's a strong price resistance, you have given them a lower option at a lower price. You've given them the possibility to choose the lower price if they don't want to pay a higher price. Now, there's also a converse to that. Sometimes customer will actually want the middle option. They want to pay a lower price, but then they realize, oh, I can't have a lower price because there's already a lower price on the table and that doesn't have the value I want. So they wind up sometimes talking themselves into the middle option. So one of the things about options is not only does it increase the likelihood of a yes, but it also makes you your own competition in the customer's mind. It also kind of predisposes the customer to saying yes, because there's a subtle shift that happens when you create options for the customer. The question in their mind, and this is subconsciously, goes from will I hire you to how will I hire you? From will I work with you to how will I work with you? That one word how, right at the beginning of the sentence, there's a subtle shift that goes from is it yes or no to well, just which one? Okay, it becomes a multiple choice question instead of a true or false question. And so that is what I would say to this question of, well, what if, you know, the customer says no, or what about that danger? I would say, well, number one, offer options. And I just gave three good reasons for it and we could continue. But options is the best way to counter that concern or that fear. And it's a real fear about a customer saying no.
And the reason why this is so important, I think, it's because when we talk about product, like, you know, a TV, a computer, people go to Best Buy, they go to Office Depot, they go to Costco, they go to a web-based store, Amazon, and they can compare the exact same model and get a price, right? Technically, if they all give the same warranty, they all give the same money-back guarantee, if they all give the same flexibility of payment, and if they all deliver the exact same product at the same time, at that point, most of the times the customer's choice will be price only, right? So that's a reality of product, correct? The reality of product. And that there are questions of loyalty and there are questions of points and rewards, and certain companies somehow get their customers to pay a little bit more for a product that's wide in the open, you know, less expensive with all the same features, same terms, same delivery system, all that stuff. Sometimes they get to do it because they have an amazing brand and they build loyalty and that sort of thing. But when it comes to services, advisory services, specifically advisory services, which is one of the least tangible things out there. It's probably something that you can't compare. I mean, you could get a proposal from three different companies about an advisory engagement, but what about these three are similar, if anything, if none, right? I mean, the only possible thing that these, especially with these management consulting firms, the only thing they can have in common is that they all charge by the hour. Or they all use the same time frame element to figure out what the, you know, how they charge. And they could have different rates, but they could have different consultants, and some are good, some are bad, some understand you, some don't, you know. So there are so many variances to like determining what's that commodity value of services, that there is no commodity value of services, and every service is so unique, which leads us to, as an advisor, to say, okay, if I present my client that binary choice of, okay, this is what you want, this is what I will charge you, and you charge by the hour, then you probably don't have, quote unquote, the fear of leaving money on the table from both sides, because both are in the understanding that this is all based on time frame. But there could certainly be the fear of, well, two things. One is, how long is this going to take? Am I going to have a surprise bill? The value of this end result, will it be lower than the amount of hours this particular person or company took to deliver that service? And that creates an immense amount of uncertainty, and it makes it very difficult, in my opinion, to sell the service plus have an amazing experience at the same time. Because it's easy to sell, hey, $150 an hour, let's see where it goes. That's particularly easy to sell. And I think for the most part, service provider and customer have, let's say, their risks a little bit mitigated, because they can stop anytime they want. But there's always that uncertainty that, you know, how long will this take? And, you know, how long will it take for this to provide any value for me? And is that value going to be higher than the end result that is delivered? So we make the shift to charging a fixed rate. And as you said, you want to give options. Because if we give the client a single binary choice, so let's say we make this move to understanding the value, and we give the client this one choice, right? This one price choice, in which me as a service provider don't want to leave money on the table or give too much value for what I'm doing, that sort of thing. I give the client one choice. But then the problem with that is the client's also left with a binary choice. And granted, I've been able to sell jobs on a single price because we spent, let's say, half a day scoping the work out, and the client said, I want one service that you provide, one thing, one price. But we dedicated a lot of time on ironing out what they want, what they don't want, and drafting, you know, basically the scope. But in most cases, I don't have 5-6 hours to discover with a client. I have maybe 30 minutes, you know, at best during tax season. In general, I'll maybe have an hour or two. And in some cases, I try to charge any time that it takes me more than 30 minutes, because I have to like think about this, right? But you know, when you don't have that much time to give the client this one price, this one service for this one scope, what you're saying, I think, is dead on, because you actually don't really know where the client is in value. You're going to lower that anxiety from both sides, yours of, am I getting this right? And the client is, am I giving a binary choice, by giving people this three prices. Now, you alluded to the power of three, or the psychological reasons of three. I think it, you know, without getting too much in detail, almost everything is done in threes, you know, like the Olympics just passed, right? You know, how many medals are given? They're given three medals, right? The gold, the silver, and the bronze. You know, anytime you see any choices on a menu, like you go to McDonald's, right? You have small, medium, large, right? You go to Starbucks and you have whatever the weird names are, venti, grande, that stuff, but they still give three choices. So I think it's become this good, better, best way of thinking, where, you know, we have, and I think it has to do with like the way that we have a left side of the brain and a right side of the brain, right? So let's call one side of the brain our cheap side, and let's call one side of the brain the one that really loves and wants that quality, right? So I think that because we have those two halves of the brain, one side just wants to go with the, you know, least expensive option, the most pragmatic and optimal choice in terms of price performance. And then the other side wants to have the best, for many reasons, the best for bragging rights, the best for being worry-free, the best for just having that feeling that, you know, there wasn't a lesser choice, that they're giving a lot of, you know, power and value to what they want. And then there's that middle choice that somehow merges the two, and it allows that logical side of your brain and that, whatever, let's call it the emotional side of your brain to merge and converge into that choice. And even so, Kirk, I think you are an expert at this. I'm not, but I'm becoming a little bit more knowledgeable about it. Even so, not everybody chooses that middle option. So maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, that it's not always the middle option that people choose. It's funny, statistically speaking, more people pick the middle choice, but maybe you can talk about some of your experiences about why people go to that, you know, lower choice or the higher choice.
Sure. So when it comes to offering three options, at some point you could just say it's common sense, simply because there are much bigger companies that invest, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars in consumer research. A lot of this is in food, but when you look at, for example, Starbucks, right? They offer three sizes. When you go through a fast food drive-in and you're going to order a value meal, typically they'll ask you, do you want that in small, medium, and large? If you look at airlines, they sell coach, business class, and first class on international flights, and we could just keep going down the list. You mentioned three medals from the Olympics. Good, better, best, I think, sums it up very well, this idea of three choices. And yes, statistically, on average, customers will choose the middle option. One of the reasons for that is psychological, simply because customers don't want to pick the least expensive thing. There is just this innate draw in us, unless we're on a tight budget or we're buying something that's very consumer. Like, you know, the other night I went to Walmart to get some things and I was buying light bulbs. Well, the Walmart brand were $1 cheaper per pack of bulbs than were the name brand. It's a light bulb. I don't give a, so I bought, you know, the cheaper, but particularly with professional services, we don't want to, in a sense, feel guilty for being cheap. We don't like to be cheap. We like to buy quality. So we'll typically overlook the lowest. Not always, but on average, yes. And the converse is true, okay? We typically don't want to spend the most money. So if we don't want to be the cheapest and we don't want to spend the most money, then that middle option is just where we're drawn. And like I said, statistically, you'll see that over and over. But there are opportunities where a couple other things happen. First of all, occasionally you will find a customer who possibly, and I've had this happen, where I felt certain they were going to go for a middle or top option, but something happened financially to them between the time we'd had our last conversation and the time we reviewed the proposal together, and they picked the lower option. They still wanted to work with me. In fact, they said, I'd really like to do the middle option, but just cash flow wise, I've got to go with the lowest right now. Now, obviously, in that situation, you might be in a position to offer options around payment terms and help them still select the middle option, but I'm kind of getting a little bit far afield. But the other opportunity is, if you never offer a high option with a high price, you're never going to collect it. You know, we always think about, man, I wish I could make more money. And my first thought is, or my first question is, well, have you ever thought about charging a higher price or offering a higher price? Or probably even a better way to say it, have you ever thought about how you could create more value for the customer in this situation, offer the customer something they didn't even know they could have? And I found that I'm surprised at the times and the customers who will actually pick that top option. In fact, I actually ran into a situation in my software company a couple of years ago where we came up with a new top option. And that would be a whole nother conversation at some point. But we took a situation where we had an ongoing concern from customers project after project. And it didn't have to do with our quality. It was just something about the process. We said, okay, here's the issue. Here's the concern. What that really means is there's value that they want that they don't feel like is being represented. So how can we give them that value and charge money for it? Because we were able to translate that, customers started picking the top option all the time. We had to come up with a new top option. Now that would be the ideal, right? Where you're offering a top option, But I would say this, if customers are statistically, on average, picking the top option most of the time, then you're not offering enough value. You're not charging a high enough price. So those are kind of some comments. Yes, on average, customers will pick the middle, but there will be situations where they need to pick the lower, a lot of times because of cash flow. Sometimes they'll surprise you and pick the higher. And if they're always picking the higher, then you're not offering enough value because you are leaving money on the table. In fact, that's how I would describe it. That's what we realized because we were consistently getting the highest option picked, we were leaving money on the table.
So there are two things at stake here, I think. And this is one of the, this is an extremely important part of shifting to advisory services, is that there's always going to be the chance that you leave money on the table because you charge too little, or you only give the client one choice, or everybody is picking that top choice, which at that point you have to obviously, like, there has to be people that just say no to that top choice. I mean, there has to be, statistically speaking, you have to have a lot of people go, ooh, that's expensive. And that's a good feeling to have, because that means that you are going to get some that take it and some that don't. So that's an extremely important piece. You have to use a three option systems to gauge whether you're charging too little or too much. As more and more people shift to that higher choice, that allows you to, you know, rethink how you're pricing to make sure you're making small shifts. So that, again, in statistically speaking, more people are not choosing that top choice, or you make that top choice high enough that people don't want it, but then your middle choice, push it a little bit up so people are more encouraged by comparison to go with the middle choice. And then all of a sudden you're making, again, you're back to getting most people pick that middle choice, but you're incrementally increasing all your options so that middle choice goes up and up and up. So that's one main issue, is you as an advisor, you cannot leave money on the table, because, you know, an advisor needs to be really good at getting value. You have to be able to be great at capturing value, because you cannot be a good advisor if you're not good at capturing value. Because at the end of the day, what customers want from their advisor is value, right? So if you're not that good at detecting it, capturing it, and getting your money's worth for it, and in turn, valuing yourself enough that you can charge what is worth, right? Or connecting with what the client feels is worth. If you can't do that, in the long run, you're just not going to be a good advisor, because, you know, you can give advice, but then your advice will lose value, you know, not to play on words there, but it will lose value over time. And then people won't really need an advisor anymore if it's just one person giving their opinion and not quote unquote valuable advice. But the other side of the coin is, you know, you need to take away that anxiety that the client, you know, can have by saying, look, if I go with them, I'm going to, you know, miss my chance to go with someone else. Or if I go with them, I'm going to end up paying too much and I'm not going to get what I want. So there's one key element that we haven't talked about, which is, what is the single most powerful way to remove that anxiety away from the, in this case, the customer, that the customer could leave money on the table or pay too much or not get their money's worth, you know? So Kirk, I hope you're reading my mind, but I want to see if we're thinking about the same thing. What is the single most powerful way we can take away that anxiety from the customer that they're leaving money at the table, or they're paying too much, or they're not going to get their money's worth? Well, in your opinion, what is the one technique, most powerful thing we can insert into our services?
So I just want to make sure that I understand your question. So what you're asking is, how do you address the anxiety that the customer may have about paying too much?
Correct. Or not getting the money's worth, let's call it that.
So first of all, I would say, refer to my previous answer about options, because the best tool you can provide for both parties, options is not just something that you as a professional offer. And yes, offering options certainly helps you as a professional avoid leaving money on the table. There's you reduce the likelihood that you're leaving money on the table by offering three options with three prices. But you also reduce the likelihood that a customer is not going to get their money's worth by offering three options. Why? Well, you're offering them choices. When you offer them choices, you are giving them an opportunity to answer the question, not am I willing to pay for value from this provider? But you shift it, how much value am I willing to pay for from this provider? So I would say options is actually a tool that works both ways. It's actually in both parties' advantage to offer options, because when you offer options, you have to set three prices, and that forces you toward the value. And it also, the customer will be driven in the same direction, because that's how they're going to evaluate which option they would pick. So my first comment would be use options, because it's in both parties' advantage. The other things that I think a customer needs to do is, I would say, number one, make sure you're working with a provider who will give you a fixed price. Now, we've had this discussion before, but is every fixed price a value price? No. Some fixed prices are just hourly billing and drag. But the bottom line is, to the customer, whether it's based on hours or value, it's a fixed price. And that's one of the best ways a customer can ensure success is by paying a fixed price. Because with a fixed price comes a fixed scope. And when you fix things, particularly the scope and the value, then you're setting a target. And it is much easier to hit a target when the target is not moving and not changing in size. And I would add to this discussion, another way that it's going to be harder for you to get your money's worth is if you're working with somebody by the hour. Customers get a false sense of comfort when they're working with a professional who bills by the hour. They think it puts them in control. It really doesn't. Now, yes, can the customer say, stop spending more hours on it? They can. But guess what happens? When they say that, usually they're left with an incomplete project, and an incomplete project is worth nothing to the customer most of the time. There are rare cases where you get some partial value out of a partial solution. I laugh whenever I hear professionals say, well, I just put the customer in charge. I bill by the hour and they can tell me when to stop. Well, you've got to realize this is not, you know, it's binary with most projects. You either deliver the value or you don't. And so the customer, they have less, they're less in charge, in my opinion, when they're billing by the hour. So I would say, make sure you have options, make sure you get a fixed price, make sure you're not working hourly. Those are ways to ensure. Third, make sure there's a process of regular communication. It is up to the professional to say, okay, during the project, here's how we're going to communicate. Here's how often we're going to communicate. When I, for example, I think one of the best things you can do is simply say, okay, we're going to have a weekly status meeting every Wednesday at 2 p.m. We're going to jump on a Skype call or GoToMeeting or the phone or even in person, whatever it is, and we're going to get together and we're going to review what work's been done in the past week, what questions have come up, what do we think we're going to accomplish the next week, are we still running on the time frame, you know, delivery time frame that we thought? Do we need to adjust that? Has something come up for either party? It's that regular communication. So I would say regular communication is part of it. Also, not in addition to regular communication, there needs to be some sort of tool in place to monitor what's going on. Some type of project management tool. I'm a big fan of Basecamp. There's Trello. There's, I think it's Asana. There's several others. But using something that basically gets you out of what I call email hell. Email is not a project management tool, and trying to track down stuff via email, it really just, it is not helpful for the customer or for you. It may seem like the easiest thing for the customer because they're used to bringing up their email program and just zipping things off, but except for the initial sender, it becomes a pain in the rear and it's hard to keep up with things. So I would say have a process that includes an online tool. So there's five ways. We could go with more. I'll give you a sixth one just because I think it's important. Look for a provider who offers a guarantee. And you may go, wait. I get a money back guarantee, you know, when I buy something from Walmart, maybe, but not from my accountant. Well, maybe you need a new accountant, because I think any professional advisor worth their weight in value and in money they receive is going to offer a guarantee. By the way, every professional offers a guarantee. Most of them just don't realize it. If you offer a guarantee up front and you do it in writing and it becomes part of your marketing and part of what you offer the customer, that's the best way to do it. But if you don't do it that way, then it's called a lawsuit. Or it's called arguing about an invoice, which, by the way, that's the reason customers argue about hourly invoices, because at that point, based on, quote, what they've received. They don't feel like the value's been there, and so they're trying to renegotiate so that they pay for the value. And that's another reason I love pricing up front, because the best time to price is when value is perceived to be the highest. And by the way, value is always perceived to be the highest when before you buy something.
So I figure you had something to say about that. So I wanted to, the theme that I like to extract from there, I'll unpack from all that is, one, we must allow the customer to set their own expectation about what they want from you through options, right? Because by that, they tell you, I'm okay with paying less, I'm getting less, and they're doing it explicitly by picking a choice. Or they're saying, no, I want the, what do you call it, the kitchen sink. I want the kitchen sink, you know, so I'm going to pay the top option. So you let the client communicate with you what their expectation of what they want from you via those options. And as you get better and better at giving options that are consumerate to that value that they're getting, you will tend to control the conversation a lot more than, you know, quote unquote, giving your client the control of out charging by the hour. So that would say that would be the one. But the second one, which is really the one that I wanted to dig from you, which you mentioned last, is that value guarantee, or that, you know, money back guarantee, or that that hey, if you're not satisfied, just, you know, don't pay me type of thing, or pay me whatever you want type of thing. And I don't want to get too much deep into it. I'm going to strongly recommend that you tune into The Soul of Enterprise. I think it was like 2 episodes ago, and our colleagues Ron Baker and Ed, you know, that are in the same Verisage Institute that you're in, talked about a book called Extraordinary Guarantees, and they talked about the examples. I think, and that was a moment of an epiphany for me, you know, which is exactly what you said, is we already offer a guarantee. Like, we already are willing to give the money back to avoid a lawsuit. We're really willing to adjust an invoice if we were unclear in the communication we were going to do. We're probably just going to, you know, let the whole thing go and say, you know what, you know, I have other better clients to deal with and other things to deal with. You know, you're right. You know, we screwed up, don't pay us. You probably already do that as an accounting professional, as an IT professional, as an advisor. You probably already do that in the first place, because you know that you swim in the world of abstract. You know that you're not selling product. It's not cut and dry like Walmart, buy something, return something. You know, it's very abstract. You know, sometimes we screw up in our scope, you know, letters of engagement or fixed price agreements, or our communication about what we will do and will not do. Sometimes we screw things up. Sometimes we're not good at even drafting the options. So we are probably already going to give a value guarantee anyway. It's going to be implicit. It's going to be implicit. It's going to be hidden. And it's only really going to be evoked when the customer is in already so mad anyway that there's no salvation. I mean, whatever you do, it's probably not going to save the customer. You're going to lose out on the customer, or the customer will leave you, and you're going to lose out on all the investment you made to bring the customer on in the first place. So I think no matter what, there already is a value guarantee that every service professional does, but not using that as a tool to explicitly make it part of your choices or make it part of what you offer, I think is how you leave the single most money on the table as a service professional. And I know it's counterintuitive, because by giving a value guarantee, that means the customer won't pay you, or the customer has a choice not to pay you, right? Or you have to give the money back. You would think, oh, wait a minute, Hector, no, that's how you leave money on the table, by giving the customer that choice. But that's not true. The way you leave money on the table is not pricing enough to be able with confidence to bring that value guarantee into the open, to be okay with a percentage of your customers saying no, because you're getting enough to compensate for that, statistically speaking. Yes, it's frustrating when a customer tells you, hey, give me my money back, I didn't get what I wanted. But you are complying with your value guarantee. And if you don't do that at least once or twice, that means you don't have a value guarantee, right? I mean, isn't that the truth? Like, if you don't give somebody the money, if you never give your client your money back, maybe you're thinking that, you know, all your services are perfect. No, actually, it probably means the opposite. It means that you're doing things in such a bad way that all these customers leaving you never communicated with you the reason why they were leaving you. And it's probably because you never gave them an open or an opportunity to say, hey, I didn't get my money's worth. I left money on the table. Most of your customers leave you. They don't tell you why. They just leave you. You know, unless you have this opportunity to talk about, you know, hey, did I get my money's worth? You know, are you going to pay this bill? Do you think you got your money's worth? So I wanted to kind of unpack it and talk about that because it was a moment of epiphany when I heard that a couple of weeks ago.
Well, I think you nailed it. Leaving money on the table is essentially not charging enough. Now, that's a very succinct answer to our definition, but yeah, that's really what it boils down to. Whenever professionals hear me talk about this idea of a guarantee, there's always a lot of objection. And, you know, the fear is that every other customer is going to want to invoke that. But I have interviewed numerous professionals, including attorneys who practice corporate litigation. And by the way, they do it at a fixed price. And over, and this has been my experience as well, from professionals who've been practicing value pricing for 5, 10, or more years, typically the number of customers who have exercised a value guarantee is less than 5. Over a 5 to 10 year period. Personally, I've only had it exercised twice. And one of the two times I was glad they did because I realized I had made a bad decision taking that customer on. In fact, it's one of those times where I kind of knew I shouldn't take them on, but I tried it anyway because I thought maybe I could, you know, beat my own instincts, and turns out I was wrong and I shouldn't have ever attempted the process. By the way, this is one of the benefits of offering a value guarantee that you won't realize is you'll get better at customer selection, because once your livelihood is at risk, or you perceive it at risk, it's really not. And we can talk about that. But once you have this perceived sense of risk, you're going to do everything you can to satisfy the customer. By the way, you should probably be a little more definitive about the value guarantee, what it is. There's two ways that I've seen it practiced. And the first is the way I practice it, and then I'll describe the way I've seen other people practice it. What I do is I simply, in the proposal, I have two guarantees. One is a service guarantee, one's a price guarantee. You could also call the service guarantee a value guarantee if you want, but let me retract that. Not necessarily, but that's another point. Anyway, service guarantee basically says, hey, if you're not satisfied with the service that we provide, we'll refund all or portion of your money that reflects your level of unsatisfaction. Price guarantee simply says, hey, for this scope of work, this is the price. If there's going to be a change in scope, then we will give you a written change request with the new scope and the new price. But the service guarantee is really the one we're talking about where we might give money back. So I just put it in writing. I just kind of say it as part of the proposal. Some people put it on their website, but basically you're just stating up front, hey, everything we do comes with this guarantee, right? You're just saying it. And a lot of times all that needs to happen for the customer is for that to be stated. Now, not just, I don't mean verbally, but in writing, either in the proposal or on the website or both. That gives them additional level of comfort, and 99.9% of the time, you're going to knock it out of the park because that's just the way you are. But it will force you to be better at customer selection. So that's the first way I've seen it practiced, is just stated in writing up front, the proposal or on the website. The second way is to actually do it on the invoice. And now, the reason I don't do it the second way is because I typically collect most, like 70 to 80% of the time, I collect all the money up front. I'm always getting paid in advance. But in those cases where customers paying after a service has been rendered or later in the process, I've seen, particularly with attorneys, it seems like this, whereas this is most prevalent, is literally on the invoice, it'll just say, hey, if you don't feel like the price above reflects a fair exchange for the value you've received, cross out the price and write in the amount that you're willing to pay. Now that sounds scary. Literally what you're doing is you're sending out an invoice that say, okay, you need to pay this much, but if you don't agree with the number, just cross it out and write in whatever you think. And the people I've talked to who do that, again, the number of times it's been exercised has been less than 5 or 6. And in fact, one attorney who practices this said that the only condition they put on the customer crossing out the amount, writing it in, the only condition they put on it is said, you must have a conversation with us to tell us what you're unhappy about. Now, they don't then go further and say, and then we'll decide if we'll give it to you. No, if you ask for it, you get whatever you write in. The only condition is you got to tell us what you're unhappy about. Why? Not so I can fix it now, so I can try to make it better next time. That's the idea. So one of two ways, either state it in writing up front or you just put it on the invoice. And again, it's an amazing tool. How confident would you be if everybody you dealt with just simply said, hey, it's a money-back guarantee? We expect it in B2C, right? In consumer-type things, Walmart, Target, et cetera. Amazon, amazing returns. There are times I'll buy things from Amazon at a higher price just because it's so easy to return something. How easy is it to return something from Amazon? Keep the box it came in, go online, click, I want to return, and I print out a prepaid label. And I just show up with the box and the label, at one of those package ship places. Here, take care of this for me, right? They made it so, so easy. All of that kind of talking about that guarantee, it's not scary. It's not exercised that much. You offer it anyway, so why not use it in your marketing? It forces you to be better at customer selection. It actually increases the confidence that customers have in you. Again, it's just like options. I could kind of keep going. You get me started on one of these points and it's kind of hard for me to turn myself off.
Right. I know. And that's why I do it. I baited you into it. Now, good that you mentioned Amazon, because I used to work for Best Buy like 12 years ago. And I remember when Amazon was this really weird, looming threat in the horizon. Like, it wasn't there yet. It was kind of there, maybe, in the future, this will be a threat, that type of thing. And today, Circuit City went under, all these electronic stores are going under. Who knows if Best Buy is going to survive. And who's the culprit? It's Amazon. But what's funny is in the past, like 10 years or so, 10, 12 years, the one thing that kept people going to retail stores versus Amazon or something web-based was, at the store, I can just go return it. Like that, I think that mentality was able to hang on for a little bit. And I think that kept these retail stores in life support. I think they're zombies at this point, but they basically overkept them in life support. It's that concept that certain people still think that, hey, if I go to the store, I could just return it. I have a person I can talk to here, give me my money back, that sort of thing. But Amazon caught on to this a few years ago, and this wasn't always the case. Amazon used to be a pain in the butt to return stuff. There used to be that stigma that, hey, if I buy an Amazon, I take this risk. Now, trust me, from an Amazon buyer that spends half his paychecks on Amazon, I can tell you it's extremely easy, exactly as you mentioned. And actually, even better, I don't have to go to the store. I can have a UPS guy pass by and pick it up. So actually, Amazon, beat retail stores at their own game, with shipping, and making it super easy to return stuff. And think about this: it is the value guarantee that allows these companies to completely take over retail. I mean, think about it. Me and my friends, we jokingly call Best Buy Amazon's showroom, right? we go look at the camera, check it out, play with it, and then order in Amazon. I mean, from an ex Best Buy employee, I know I shouldn't be doing that, but that is the reality of things. And it is that value guarantee. It is that concept that you won't leave money on the table from the customer's perspective that is going to allow you to up the value. And yes, execute some refunds, execute some value guarantee, but that will still be a small percentage. But the amount of value you increase to your service, which allows you to drive the price up and be able to get more bang for the buck from your perspective, when you give the client, when you take away that anxiety that, hey, I'm not going to get my money's worth, or I'm not going to leave money on the table. So I'm with you 100% on that.
Again, I really think terminology and language is important. And at least for me personally, I would use the term leaving money on the table to talk about the professional pricing. When we're talking about the customer buying, I would prefer the term buyer's remorse or buyer's regret. So just kind of a little bit of a clarification there.
Yeah. Let me ask you another question, Kirk, because we're almost done with the hour here. That I honestly think that the single most important thing, skill that an advisor needs to learn, in my opinion, and this is not unbiased, this is based on what I've observed with myself and my colleagues, is pricing. I think price fixes everything. And I'll give you a couple of examples, and then I want to ask you, you know, how do people go about that, about it, just getting really good at pricing? But these are a couple of examples I can use on why I think pricing fixes everything. I had a client a couple of weeks ago, well, a lead that saw one of my videos on YouTube and contacted me and said, Hector, I want to hire you to import some data into my QuickBooks or something like that. And then I say, sure, let me connect. I'm going to connect you with my partner, Alex, who's an expert at this. They say, no. I want to work with you and you only. And I said, well, why does it have to be me and me only? Well, because I saw your video, because I like you, because whatever. And I said, sure, I'm still going to give you the choice of Alex because he has a little bit more availability than me. So we're going to set up an initial statement to review your data file and so we can give you a full scope for the project. So I basically gave him two choices. I gave him the choice to do it with me and the choice to do it with Alex. And mine was double the price, right? So that causes a lot of anxiety, by the way. Like if you're a service professional and you give a client two choices, you know, person A, person B, two prices, that could cause some anxiety because in the client's mind, what are they going to think? Well, one's better than the other. That is possible, right? So this was just an experiment that I was doing. I don't know if this was right or wrong. Kirk, I'll let you judge that afterwards. So I did that, and the client immediately called me back and goes, hey, you know, I said I wanted the best. I want to work with you, but I don't understand why you charge so much more. So I caused a self-inflicted wound here. And what I told the customer, and this is just came up the way, and I said, look, you know, I spend 50% of my time creating content, which is a lie, by the way. And I'm sorry, customer, if you're watching, you know, I spend 50% of my time creating content in YouTube, and I have extremely limited availability. I purposely price myself higher, knowing and guaranteeing that you get the exact same result from me or my partner to just give me back that time that I need to create value for my business through my YouTube videos. Therefore, I price myself out of the jobs on purpose so customers can see that it's actually not worth it, you know, to just be so stubborn about having to work with one person if I'm guaranteeing you the same value with the other person. The client goes, you know what? You're right. You know, if you guarantee me the result, I'll work with your partner, Alex. So I fixed the problem through pricing. I mean, I think I created some sort of other problems. I was able to fix it through the conversation, but I fixed it through pricing because I didn't want to do the work. It's just, I just didn't have time. It was like a 3-day job over the whole weekend. And I just didn't have the time. I'm spending my time doing other things right now. I still work, but I mean, I just didn't have the amount of time that they wanted. So I think I fixed it through pricing, quote unquote, causing all the problems. I'll let you comment on that. And then I'll give you another example. Just yesterday, I was sitting with one of my clients who's a big landscaper, does over $1 million in sales. That was beautiful work. And he's trying to understand, you know, hey, where's my profit? Where's my profit? I don't understand why I'm struggling if I'm doing so well. You know, I'm busy, right? I'm busy. How come I'm not? And we basically looked at every single expenditure. And what he wanted me to do is to find an expense to cut. Like he wanted me to like wave a magic wand and say, you cut that expense and cut that expense, and somehow your business will be the same, and then you'll be profitable again. And we spent like 5 hours. And at the end of the day, I said, going back to the first thing I said, I think you just increase your prices by 5%, and then you will have an extra $50,000 in your pocket. And that's it. Those are the $50,000 you're looking for. Just increase your sales by 5%. He said, well, what if my clients leave? Great. The ones that leave give you capacity to increase it by 10%. And he's like, whoa. So I think that at the end of the day, I think pricing sort of fixes everything, especially coming from someone that says, I'm busy. I'm having a lot of leads. I'm you know, if you're busy, 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 if you're at capacity, you're probably underpricing in humongous ways. I mean, in my opinion, and this is something that I've forcibly done to myself, I'm at 60% capacity at all times, 50% capacity at all times. This has been a huge transformational shift for me. 2 years ago, a person will text me and say, hey, let me ask you, can I ask you a quick question? I would put him in the system, right? Wait 2 weeks to talk to me, that sort of thing. Because I was always trying to just be at capacity, and I was pricing myself just enough to be at capacity, thinking that I was being efficient and optimal. But now that I'm at 50% capacity, I have the 5-10 minutes to answer those, we can call them stupid questions. They're not stupid questions, but those little tiny questions that I before gave my client a really bad service by putting them in the scheduling system. And now I'm able to discover and uncover incredible opportunities just by giving my client those 5 minutes. But the way I did that is through pricing. I price myself out of jobs purposefully so I can open up my capacity. So that's my take on why I think pricing fixes everything. And I think the reason why it has had the best impact in my business. And by the way, if you're a potential customer watching this and you're going to talk to me, I'm not going to overcharge you, but I'm probably going to be the most expensive person you talk to, because when I work with someone, I give it all, right? And when I don't work with someone, I relax, right? So when I do work with someone, I price enough to give it all. And that's a really important concept of pricing and giving yourself that capacity to give it all to those clients that want it all. So Kirk, how can people, again, just how can people get better at pricing? Because I think that fixes everything.
I agree. Pricing covers a multitude of sins is one of my favorite phrases. I would also add, and this is kind of a cliffhanger, that you actually provide your best work when you charge your highest price. We'll have to unpack that in a future episode. But if you're interested in getting better at pricing, I'm working on something. It's in the early stages. I don't have a web page for it yet, but I am going to be starting this spring a coaching group specifically for accounting and bookkeepers who are interested in getting better at pricing, who are actually interested in learning to price, because pricing is not a skill that is taught in business school or in college textbooks or those kind of things. You rarely find it in any type of, you know, CPE course unless I or Ron are teaching it. So pricing is not something that we develop naturally. I think it's the most important skill. You just gave two great examples of how pricing was the lever that you were able to pull to handle a couple of different situations. So if you're interested in developing pricing as a skill and you'd like to work with me in a coaching environment, the commitment will be probably a couple of in-person sessions per month, as well as, and when I say in-person, I mean online. And then we'll also provide probably a Slack channel for you to be able to communicate in between those sessions. If you're interested in that, reach out to me, Kirk@Art of Value. I'll have more information on that once I get the webpage ready, but I thought I would go ahead and share that. So if there's somebody in the audience who knows right now they want to be a part of that, they can reach out and get at the front of the line.
So I assume you said spring because it's after tax season, right? The proverbial tax season.
See, now you're going to make me do another cliffhanger. I'm going to throw this out there. I don't believe there should be a thing such as tax season.
Yeah. Yeah. From your mouth to God's ears, my friend. So thank you very much. I think that was a great conversation, Kirk. And we'll be anxious to hear what a mastermind type group would look like. Any parting words?
Nope. I'll just see you next week. I'm looking forward to it.
See you next week, Kirk. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you.